kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me in my
life. Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Today we have a special program. Normally, we begin our programs with the latest on health and healing. Generally, it takes about 20 minutes. Then we shift over to the environment, giving you the latest on environmental insights. Then on public health issues. Then our guest or issue of the day. Today, we're going to change that because yesterday, in a historic move, a group of countries led by the United States signed in New Zealand the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It will still take some time to fully implement. However, it is my personal opinion that this is the most dangerous piece of legislation ever enacted in the United States history. What this will do will devastate workers. It will take away all of our protections, as you will hear, because in a moment we're going to go to a gentleman who has spent so much time, Dr. Michael Hudson. Professor Hudson has been on this program many times. He is quite simply one of the world's leading economists, and he will give us his unique insights as to what this means. Now, I will not have a chance, because of the length of my discussion with Dr. Hudson, to have the full interview on. I'll get all the important points, I can assure you. But you can continue to hear the full discussion on our website. Then we will play about an 8-minute clip from a very important and original investigative report on the abuses and the fraud of psychiatry. That is not to condemn all psychiatrists. There are some psychiatrists who do good work helping people, but it's not through pharmacology. Today, Dr. Robert Galen from Bangor, Maine. He has been a practicing therapist for over 40 years, and he received his doctorate in biological psychology from City University of New York, taught at Vassar College, Thomas Jefferson University Medical School, and the University Psychosomatic Medical Clinic. And we are going to debate the issue of deconstructing the psychiatric paradigm that mental disorders are medical diseases. They are not, not one of them. And an alternative ecological model that understands mental behavior. This is not to suggest that people do not have mental problems, frequently making them so severe that they are incompatible with being able to maintain a healthy coexistence in a family or in a society. But what psychiatry chooses to do is virtually make all normal life behaviors into a pathology. That is wrong. Excuse me. So what we're going to do is we're going to explore this. Excuse me. Have something in my throat. Now, let us go now, bypassing health and nutrition. We're going to talk with Dr. Hudson. I'll have to switch between a telephone, because I'm on the road, and a microphone, a portable microphone. And let me suggest to people in this audience, especially those listening from our sister station, WBAI New York, it's very important to have this number, so if any time you call in and you do not hear my program, if it should be preempted for any reason, you can always listen live. Here is the number, 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. Anywhere in the United States and Canada, every day at noon, you can call that number and you can hear this program. And if for some reason your terrestrial station's not working, you can always listen to it, as so many people do throughout the world, over the internet at theprogressiveradionetwork.com. Now to a discussion on the Trans-Pacific Partnership with Professor Michael Hudson. Nice to have you with us today, Michael.
It's good to be here, Gary. It's amazing that your show, by focusing on the Trans-Pacific Agreement, is covering what is not in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. You're absolutely right. The agreement is the most important act of the century, if it were to be passed, because it would essentially abolish the role of government to pass environmental legislation, to regulate corporations, to support public health, without paying enormous fines to the companies that are being doing the pollution.
Ralph Nader has described the Trans-Pacific Partnership as the most brazen corporate power grab in American history. It was being crafted by the corporate elite well before Obama came to office, perhaps with the expectation that Hillary Clinton would have won the election because the Clintons gave Wall Street and the corporatocracy the gifts of the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, and CAFTA, and remove Glass-Steagall. Obama, on the other hand, ran on the false promise he would renew a look at all of these past agreements, and which, by the way, sent millions of jobs overseas and eradicated American manufacturing. And he would make appropriate changes. Well, so far, most of what we hear about the Trans-Pacific Partnership has focused on patent laws and repression of the Internet, and no longer having food safety, no longer having real protection with pharmaceutical drugs, and a continuation of promoting fossil fuels and removing trade barriers in favor of toxic products. But we don't hear much about Wall Street's role and the huge investment banks and the larger financial commodities complexes. So I'm hoping you can bring some light to the shadow side of the government and the private industries working together in secret. Hundreds and hundreds of corporate lobbyists worked together. They wouldn't allow anyone to know what was in it. And right off the bat, I would ask the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, I would ask any legislator, why wouldn't you make this transparent? If it was to protect the public, if it was to enhance our well-being, if with our health and safety and the environment, then tell us what's in it. They wouldn't. And yet there didn't seem to be any great concern by anyone except your normal activists who do show interest, like Public Citizen, Lori Wallach. And as a result, there have been today, all over the world, protests, really a lot in New Zealand, because that's where it's being signed, by the nations involved. It still has a way to go to fully implement it. But we're asked by the Blue Dog Democrats, the Hillary Clintons, well, we needed this. In fact, we have the actual statements on 44 separate occasions where she was letting the State Department run roughshod over any country that didn't want to do the this trade agreement, and also running roughshod on genetic engineering. She was behind the scenes promoting genetic engineering. And so here we have a whole lot of people saying, this is good for us, and yet when the experts come forward and say, no, it's not, and here's WikiLeaks showing this is very damaging, the media doesn't cover it. So take us A to Z through why we should really be very concerned as of today.
Well, the experts say one thing and the lobbyists say another. While the lobbyists have been writing the Trans-Pacific Agreement, you may ask, what made Obama take a new look at the agreement? Well, he looked at the agreement, and then he looked at who his campaign contributors were, and the largest political campaign contributors in America today are the financial sectors members, the banks and the investment banks. And they're the engineers behind the corporate takeover. So, of course, they're backing the Democratic and Republican candidates who commit themselves to signing this secret agreement. And the reason it's secret is if people knew what's in it in other countries in America, if the agreement were put up to a referendum democratically, it would be overwhelmingly rejected. Now, instead of putting it up to a referendum, and as you said, this is the most important law in not only a century. This abolishes the rule of governments to make their own laws as they concern public health, consumer protection, and environmental pollution. It takes this power out of their hands. Well, this is a gigantic thing, and of course people would vote against it. In Europe, certainly, there's already been a fight about labeling genetically engineered crops and country of origin, and all this would be illegal under the trade agreements that are being done. I'm glad you focused on what Hillary said, because I think the questions tonight on MSNBC for the debate between Hillary and Bernie Sanders really should focus upon this and to pin her down. My guess is that she's going to give a lawyer-speak answer and say, well, of course she's going to support what's good for her constituency, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership is good for women, and she's going to try, what Wall Street has tried to do is mobilize all of the identity politics in America. So, in effect, when they say, well, we want the women for Hillary, what they're really saying is, we want women for the 1%. We want women for Wall Street. We want women for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And when they put together the gay and lesbian lobbying groups, it's really, these groups are headed by Wall Street billionaires who contribute heavily to the Hillary's campaign, or more overtly to the Republicans. So it's really the gay and lesbians for Wall Street and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And these identity groups fighting for their own rights and their own identity have somehow been hijacked into supporting politicians that are in the support of a Trans-Pacific Partnership. And we shouldn't really call it partnership. It's really the corporate takeover of government, because under these rules, governments will forfeit the ability to make environmental laws, and this will pass into corporations. On Tuesday, Elizabeth Warren gave a very good speech in the Senate all about what's in this agreement and why the senators should oppose it. I didn't see this covered anywhere in the New York Times or in the Wall Street Journal, or even in the Financial Times. It is on the Common Dreams website. So you're having almost all of the technical discussion of how radical and anti-government and anti-democratic this rule is, only on the internet and on shows like yours.
I'm concerned that the largest single powerful bloc in the United States that could have stopped this, and still could, from actually being implemented, are the unions. When you think about the unions being lied to by the Clintons and the corporate Democrats with NAFTA, and we saw how many jobs were lost, how many factories closed, 58,000 American factories closed between 2000 and 2012. That was one consequence of NAFTA. And then you see that the wages that were being paid in Vietnam and Bangladesh and China to make a garment, to make a tire, to make an oven, to make a bicycle, to make a television was so low that Americans couldn't compete. So the word was, if you want to keep your job, then we're going to reduce your pay or reduce your hours. So we've seen people now who once had for 40 years, from 1945 until about 1980, they had a living wage. They had savings. They didn't have massive debt. Now we have massive debt. We don't have savings for most people. And yet we're told, just today, with Royal Dutch Shell, they've got to lay off 10,000 employees. Why? Because they're only going to net $1.7 billion in this new quarter. And I'm thinking, if I was the president of that company, I would save those 10,000 jobs. Just tell your stockholders, we need to consider the livelihood, the families, the living conditions within a community. If there's no money to pass around, it'll become, it'll become a ghetto. So we take a little less profit this time, but at least other people benefit. And corporate America doesn't believe that any stockholder has any desire to see anyone else do well except give me my money, give me my dividend. And so companies that are still making money are making money by firing people, downsizing people, hiring people from other countries who have PhDs to come in and take the place of people who worked there for 20 years, maybe making a good wage. And they've done this with 8 million American workers over the last 9 years. Plus, they're closing more factories, and we're ending up not manufacturing very much anymore. But we're still in deals, trade deals now, with the very countries that will be able to exploit their labor force because they don't have the same environmental laws, they don't have the same OSHA laws, they don't have the same minimum wage laws that we have. And the union should see this. This is a giant red flag saying to the rank and file, how many of the people running unions have compromised their positions in order to maintain their power and, let's say, their association and the opportunity to have access to the leaders in government, including the Clintons. The teachers' union just sided with Hillary Clinton, nominated her. You would have thought that, if anything, the teachers, knowing that there's a massive privatization effort, and the Clintons helped usher that in. And Obama's been a major advocate of the charter schools and privatization of education. And you would want someone like Jill Stein, the third party, the Green Party candidate, who believes in traditional educational standards and bringing power back to the school teachers. Yet the rank and file in all these unions are either unaware, or they have, with apathy, allowed the people who run the unions to go along with the status quo, and they'll go along with the union, they'll go along with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I'm saying now, if this Trans-Pacific Partnership becomes a full-blown reality after being signed today, you will see the complete destruction of all unions in the United States, with the possible exception of federal and state and city worker unions, civil servant unions, but all the other unions and all the people who want to have a living wage, not going to happen in the future. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think you're quite correct about the point on unions. Yesterday, Richard Trumka of the AFL-CIO came right out and said that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is worse than even had been let on initially, that it would be a disaster for unions, and because one of the leading aspects of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is to destroy the government's ability to protect labor. If the government were to pass a rise in minimum wages, that would enable McDonald's or Walmart or any other company to sue the government for the added cost that they have to incur to pay their wages as a result of the government ruling. In other words, any ruling the government does, if you have to raise taxes on property or finance, then you have to pay the financial sector what they would have made if the government hadn't made this law. If the government fines, say, Exxon or another company for polluting Ecuador's land as a result of an oil spill, the government has to then pay Exxon the amount of the fine because any government rule against a corporation has to be fully compensated, and Exxon has to be reimbursed for the profits it would have made if it would have continued to pollute the environment at the rate that it had before because anti-pollution rules are ruled out. But the anti-labor rules of the Trans-Pacific Partnership are the most important. Trumka's speech didn't get very well covered. He did write an op-ed, but it wasn't published in the New York Times opposing this. And you mentioned the teachers' union, and that's a very good example. I think the daughter of the head of the teachers' union is one of the fundraisers for Hillary. And so I think that the point has come where union members have to stand up and say, if a union supporter gives to a political candidate, such as Hillary, whose intention is to pursue the Trans-Pacific Partnership that would essentially destroy union power and be anti-labor, then we have to throw out such a person. I mean, it's amazing that in the last few days or weeks, you have unions coming out in support of Hillary simply because they or their family members are already campaigning for her. And the question is this going to bind the members? Are the members going to stand for the fact that the political leadership has been co-opted as in what Bernie Sanders calls the establishment? And the establishment, meaning Wall Street, is all for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And so you have rot at the very top of the labor unions in this country, hardly a new phenomenon as we've gone back. But this is exactly the issue that should become central between Bernie Sanders and Hillary. You're right to point out her support. I think Ralph Nader is doing a wonderful job, and Lori Wallach certainly continues to do a wonderful job in explaining just paragraph by paragraph what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to do to the whole economy.
I appreciate those insights, Michael. My concern is that too many Americans are distracted. They're distracted by issues in their own life. They are aligned with personality politics, meaning that if whatever a Bill O'Reilly or let's say Glenn Beck and Rachel Maddow, whatever they say, their followers believe and don't feel a need to do any further research. If Rush Limbaugh says something, he's got millions of people who go along with him. The trouble is we don't have enough independent-minded people who are willing to say, I don't know who's right now. I don't know what is right. I'd better look for some independent, non-biased information and see for myself. That's not being done. But when people do their homework, they're aghast at what they find. For example, about 90% of American families believe in full vaccination because they were conditioned to believe it was safe and effective. And who would lie to them? Their physician, the pharmacist, the nurse? No. So they go along with it. And then they end up with an autistic kid or some damage to a child or seizures in a child. And the only thing they can attribute that to, since it was a normally developing child, was the vaccines. And then they do their homework. And then they start finding out that, gee whiz, this information was there all along, but not in official news sources. And hence, they said, well, the only information I ever got was from official sources. If my pastor told me, a rabbi, imam, I believed them. If the doctor told me, I believed it. If a journalist told me, I read it, I believed it. If a commentator on television or radio said it, I believed it. And the trouble is, even people who may be well-intentioned, I do not know everyone's motive, can still be easily themselves misled, and then everybody develops this herd mindset, and we go over a cliff. And the one group in America as a group that is now challenging the vaccination of their children are one of the highest educated level groups of women in America. The scientists, the physicists, and the PhD women at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. And it was a unique phenomenon to find this out. And then when questioned, why are you questioning vaccines? They said, well, simple. We did the research. And the research does not show any basis in faith of safety and efficacy for all these vaccines. So we chose to err on the side of caution with our children. Well, now we have union members who have believed faithfully in their union leaders. We have union leaders, some who are honoring what their mandates are to honor their membership, but others are aligning themselves politically, like the teachers union and their other unions. And Hillary is fully a functional person who is a corporatist. I don't think she really cares about the identity politics of being a Democrat or a progressive. She's not a progressive. None of the Democrats are real progressives. And she cares about power. Her husband cares about power. He has charisma. She does not. He is one of these good old boys who will do whatever it takes to to make sure that he and his associates are taken care of. Well, his associates happen to be former Secretary of the Treasury, Lawrence Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin, and one of their proteges, Timothy Geithner. One of his friends was the head of the Federal Reserve. And then he selected, after Alan Greenspan, then one of Greenspan's chosen ones. They don't just come in off the street and say, I'm here, I'm going to reform this house. You are selected. You're selected based upon following the same pedigree. You don't change anything radically. Yeltsin, who has the Federal Reserve now, she was selected for the same reason. She's not going to change anything. The trouble is these people have led us over a cliff with the mind groupthink. I mean, you can't get any more Orwellian than what we're getting today. The media is not going to tell you the truth on any of these. So if you want to know the truth about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you mentioned in the beginning of this conversation, you're not going to read it in the New York Times. They're pro-everything. They endorsed Hillary Clinton. We gave a litany of the crimes against humanity that she has been personally responsible for, including Libya. And I said the other day in a commentary, I said, any reporter for the New York Times or anyone who is responsible for its editorial content, like its editorial board, would you take a week, go to Libya, go to some of the neighborhoods where there's just normal people living, spend a week with them, see the crisis they're in, then ask them to tell you, what was it like before we invaded? Of the 54 countries in Africa, Libya was number one in wealth per person. Gaddafi, even though he was a megalomaniac, he shared the wealth. In fact, every time they sold oil, it went into your bank account. You were given free education at any level you chose to go to, free medical care. You were given a house. If you wanted to farm, you were given a tractor, seeds, and farmland that you own. Women had the same rights as of 1970 as men. And they could also gain the inheritance, own property, and it wasn't a male child. It was the woman. No other Arab country had that. Now, you had more women in positions of power than any other country in Middle East or Africa. And you had the largest private reservoir. You had you were against terrorism. There was no terrorism going on. So now take a look at it. In fact, at one time, Tripoli was considered the Paris of Northern Africa. Now take a look. Now go in and say, was it worth it? Now remember the last time someone said to a person in power, was it worth it? It was Leslie Stahl in 60 Minutes asking Madeleine Albright, who was both Secretary of State and the UN ambassador at one time, was it worth 500,000 dead children from the sanctions from the Clintons? And she said yes. And I'm quite sure today that Hillary Clinton and her supporters will say anything she does, it's worth it. Yet no one's willing to look at the consequences of her actions, and Bernie Sanders will be the last person in the world who will ever touch her. He will not dare risk his position in Congress as a senior senator and a powerful committee head. He does not want to be ostracized. So there is this stay behind of the Clintons. About 1,400 major bureaucrats, technocrats, and civil servants were appointed, and they're there representing the Clintons on all issues. And hence, nothing's going to change. So even in a debate where he could say, look at Libya today, that's your problem. You say, we came and he died. Did you see how he died? Do you want to show in your campaign a picture of Gaddafi being sodomized? Do you want to see him being beaten to death? Is that, you're proud of that? And you also voted for the invasion of Iraq. You want to go to Iraq for a week, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post? You want to go and spend, of all the journalists in America, you want to go and spend a week living in Fallujah? See what it's like for the people? Because they got to still live there. You don't. No one in America has to go anyplace. We have the comfort of living in denial for all the mistakes we make. So when I look at Hillary Clinton, and I look at Wall Street, and I look at Washington, D.C., and I look at the major media, and I look at academia, and I look at the pathetic excuse for our student and academicians today, and I look at how few activists we have, and I look at how people are so willingly compromised for gaining some advantage, whether it's monetary, celebrity status, or power, I'm saying you have seen nothing yet until you see when this Trans-Pacific Partnership is fully implemented and you wake up one day and you say, what happened to the label that shows where this product was grown? Well, they didn't want that. Where was it grown? We don't know. I heard that there was arsenic in chickens in China. We don't know where that chicken came from. I heard that there was mass contamination. They fed pig feces to shrimp and tilapia in Thailand and China. We don't know. There's no label. Why aren't things labeled right? Because the Trans-Pacific Partnership doesn't want it. I don't see any warning on this pesticide I'm supposed to spray around my house. You won't. Why? Because you can't warn people. You can't? No. And then you start realizing all the ways we've become a police state, a completely fascist corporatocracy. Your thoughts, Michael?
Well, you begin by saying that people depend on either the talk show people or experts.
You're listening to one of the finest musical groups ever, Earth, Wind, and Fire. And the founder of Earth, Wind, and Fire just passed, which is unfortunate. Extraordinarily talented person. I saw Earth, Wind, and Fire perform last year in New York at the Beacon Theater. And another passing, another rock legend, just yesterday. Now, and the full discussion with Michael you can hear later today on our website. It goes on for another 20 minutes. Now let us listen to a short clip. Piece by piece, we're educating the public about what's wrong with the existing paradigm for psychiatry.
The internet, and all of a sudden you find out this is, it's not uncommon. But it's not uncommon for people to become psychotic on these drugs.
We're entitled to know the truth before we give a mind-altering drug to our children, our wife, our mother, our father, ourselves.
We don't really know what they're doing. That's what scares me. It's all made-up theory. There are no facts about what these drugs really do. And if someone said, well, we don't know what this is going to do to you, good or bad, would you take that medication?
Now, that is not the practice of medicine. That's the practice of marketing. And this practice of marketing is taking lives. And the poor patient doesn't even know it.
But in the testing and marketing of psychotropic drugs, money trumps safety. The top 10 most prescribed psychotropic drugs gross over $26.5 billion annually, more than double the amount of new money put into circulation every year by the United States Mint. But to make this kind of money, psychiatrists first have to convince the most crucial market segment of all, those with the power of prescription.
The psychiatrists specifically, they're just kind of working as sales agents for the pharmaceutical companies.
There's nothing like another doctor touting the benefits of your drug to drive market share.
They're an extended part of the marketing arm of these companies.
Medications play a primary role.
We give drugs.
Medication is a must.
There's a lot of new medications.
There are medications available for treating GAD.
Medications to use for PTSD.
PTSD.
Antipsychotic medications.
Atypical antipsychotics.
Benzodiazepines.
Stimulants.
Antidepressant medications.
MAOIs.
Amphetamines.
Anticonvulsive medications.
Once the medications have been balanced out,
then we move on to a combination of three medicines.
There's no absolute limit that is set for the number of medications.
There are so many choices.
Apparently, we're willing to try almost anything.
Psychiatric drugs can't be sold without a prescription. So pharmaceutical companies hire psychiatrists to promote psychiatric drugs to their fellow prescribers. The money trail starts at the world's most prestigious medical schools, in the offices of highly influential university-based or academic psychiatrists. With their seal of approval, pharmaceutical companies make billions on psychotropic drugs.
There are a lot of academic psychiatrists especially who have ties to 10 or 15 or 20 different pharmaceutical companies. And so they're making a very large amount of money.
Whether they're professors or whether they work at big, you know, medical institutions, those drug companies will make sure that they've got them on the payroll somehow.
They'll have this person feed this information to their other peers, but it's all being motivated through monies being funded by pharmaceutical companies.
About 40% of the early stage marketing dollars for pharmaceutical companies go straight to these thought leaders, psychiatrists.
These financial arrangements with so-called key opinion leaders are very lucrative. A top academic psychiatrist can personally rake in over $500,000 per year from pharmaceutical companies.
These people are still considered the stars of their medical centers because they bring in all this great money from the pharmaceutical companies, and that helps keep the coffers of the medical center full.
Universities receive a lot of money from the pharmaceutical industry. Drug companies are building buildings right next to the medical school. They're funding research right and left.
The University of Michigan Depression Center received, I think it was $750,000 from Eli Lilly. And all they do down there is crank out this biological view of psychiatry and mental illness and depression.
With academic psychiatrists collecting millions in drug money for their universities, it is no surprise that school curricula focus on psychotropic drugs.
Training programs in psychiatry, the majority of them now are drugs first. You know, you're really a psychopharmacologist in a way when you come out of a psych residency training program.
Even when I went to medical school, psychiatrists did talk to patients. Now all they do is write a prescription and send them away.
A psychiatrist is trained for one purpose, to administer psychiatric drugs.
Academic psychiatrists don't just indoctrinate future prescribers. They also heavily promote these drugs to their peers. First, by creating clinical trial studies, passed off as unbiased research, that push both an invented psychiatric disorder and the drug to manage it. These studies are planted in professional journals to be read by their colleagues and quoted in the media. But what readers don't know is that an estimated 50% of the time, these psychiatrists never took part in the studies.
One of the most unethical practices we're aware of is ghostwriting of journal articles, where somebody at the pharmaceutical company will write the paper and the academic physician will put his name on it and get it published in a major journal when he maybe changed three or four words in the whole article, and the article was basically written as a marketing tool by the drug company, and yet this academic puts his name on it as if he's the author.
He has had no part in the study, and also he probably hasn't even read the study results, but he is prepared to receive $10,000-$20,000 to put his name at the front of the research, which gives it added authority.
Ghostwriting is so common that even the psychiatrist running the FDA department evaluating psychiatric drug safety has attached his name to ghostwritten articles.
The average physician picks that up and reads it. He believes it. And it's not a mystery that he would believe it. It seems reasonable that it's in black and white, it's in a good journal, it's in the New England Journal of Medicine, it must be true.
These journals are often sent free to psychiatrists and doctors under the guise of legitimate medical research. And why are they free? Because pharmaceutical drug ads reap huge revenues for their publishers.
So if you go through a medical journal, you'll see page after page of advertising for bipolar disorder and treatment of using medications or advertisings for depression and the treatment of using medications, schizophrenia. So it's really everywhere.
I remember
just a couple of years ago, the first time I opened the journal from the American Psychological Association called the APA Monitor, and there was a multi-page ad, high gloss, very expensive, for Concerta, which is time-release Ritalin. I resigned from the American Psychological Association. I wasn't going to be part of this whatsoever.
It's very hard when your major source of income is advertising and advertising placement to write an article that's negative about a particular drug and expect that company to continue to buy ads in your medical journal. So that's a major issue.
But psychiatric key opinion leaders aren't satisfied with filling medical journals with ghostwritten articles. They also spread the gospel of psychotropic drugs at conferences in continuing medical education, or CME.
Physicians and nurse practitioners and physicians and assistants are mandated to take a certain amount of continuing education credits every year. Well, 70% of all continuing medical education is now funded by the pharmaceutical industry.
That seminar is going to be taught by a professional who is employed by the pharmaceutical company. The very nature of where someone is giving you your support means you are biased to that person's side.
Many physicians and many psychiatrists who attend medical conferences don't know that when they go to that conference meeting that's about antidepressants, antipsychotics, and it's generally a academic psychiatrist who's speaking, they don't realize that person's probably making about $10,000 for that 1 hour speech.
But you don't have to be an academic psychiatrist to get a piece of the pie. Psychiatrists who heavily prescribe psychotropic drugs are generously rewarded by pharmaceutical sales representatives for drumming up local business.
Psychiatrists, especially high prescribers, are targeted and gifted extensively by the industry. Now, that gifting is where you need to get specific.
That was not unusual during our marketing conversations to say, well, what's our top drug writer? You know, who's the doctor that's prescribing the most of this drug? Well, you know, let's send them to the Kentucky Derby.
We offered trips on some occasions to come out and hear a two-hour talk, but it happened to be on a nice island in Hawaii.
There were a lot of things that we did, Dave.
These are just a few of the insights. Most of the people you were just listening to are psychiatrists, and one of the pieces I have yet to play is undercover camera work where a completely normal, healthy individual was sent in to 12 leading board-certified psychiatrists. They were not just randomly selected. These were the leaders of the field. And within 2.5 to 7 minutes, they were diagnosed with a mental condition, a psychiatric disorder, and given a prescription drug. Now, what's of interest is later, on the street, you will then see them confronted. And a simple question, this is a completely healthy person. What objective scientific test did you take into account to determine the diagnosis? Well, there are none. If there are no tests to determine a person has an actual medical condition that you're calling a psychiatric condition, then why not give them a placebo? Because here are the actual scientific studies showing that a sugar pill is equally as beneficial as your nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, or excuse me, your selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drugs. And they just look at you quizzically. And they're not even ashamed of it. And that was the irony. They just walk on. So this has been a long time effort, and the full impact will be seen when I premiere the film and a series of articles taking apart piece by piece the myth of psychiatry as a legitimate healing profession. Joining me now on the phone from Bangor, Maine, is Dr. Robert Gallon, G-A-L-L-O-N. He has been a practicing psychologist for over 40 years, specializing in medical psychology. He received his doctorate in biological psychology from City University of New York and taught at Vassar College and later at Thomas Jefferson University Medical School, where he, while practicing at the university's psychosomatic medical clinic, he served as the child psychologist at Eastern Maine Medical Center.
Chief psychologist.
chief psychologist, all right, where he founded its chronic pain program and serves as an examiner for the State Forensic Service to evaluate defendants' competency to stand trial. He's also the author of several books, including Nine Dimensions of Madness, Redefining Mental Health, which comprehensively debunks many of the myths that mental disorders are medical diseases and offers an ecological alternative. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
I'd like to have you explain, based upon 40 years in this field, and therefore you have witnessed many of the ins and outs of the psychiatric and psychological profession that dominates mental health today, the issue that as we age, we become wiser, hopefully, and develop broader perspectives on important issues. So can you summarize for us what you have witnessed as the transformation of the mental health profession during this period? And in the course of your career, what have been the more alarming developments in the diagnosis and treatment of mental health that has disturbed you the most?
Okay. Let me start out by saying, you know, listening to the lead-up piece, there are no diseases in mental health. There's no diabetes, no cancer, and no mental condition is specifically treated by medication. I call this the medicalization of mental health occurred as is probably the most successful marketing campaign in recent memory. And it originated long at the start of when I started practicing. Because it started because, you know, psychiatrists, when I started out, were all Freudians. And the psychiatric diagnostic manual was a thin little thing, all psychoanalytic, and ignored. And a lot of psychiatrists were saying, why bother with these diagnoses? Who cares? You know, they don't mean anything. Well, the problem was that psychiatry was falling behind medicine. Medicine was becoming more and more scientific. It was, you know, you were proving things. There were tests. Psychiatry had nothing. So what was going to legitimize psychiatry as a medical profession if they were not treating diseases? So the first thing that happened was in the 60s. This was when I was in college and graduate school. The pharmaceutical companies, you know, really grew to treat some legitimate diseases, but they wanted blockbuster drugs. And the psychiatric field was fertile territory. So if you look at the headlines from the 1960s, you read about all these new miracle drugs. Many of them weren't very new, and they weren't miracles. But they got labeled as specific to disorders. So you had antipsychotics and antidepressants and mood stabilizers, etc. And psychiatry took this as, well, collaborated at the time, to make psychiatry medical, because then there was a theory that, if these drugs were aiding or treating mental conditions, then they were treating chemical imbalances. And in a way, I believed that at the time. I said, well, you know, it's good to see a scientific approach, and maybe there are chemical imbalances. Unfortunately, it was marketing. It turned out that nobody's ever found chemical imbalances. Nobody's ever assayed the brain and showed that there was some kind of chemical imbalances. It was opinion. There were no real diseases. And in fact, if you look at the history of medicine, so-called mental disorders, whenever they were proved to be diseases, became neurological diseases. Almost nobody would call Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's and the results of syphilis. Nobody calls these mental illnesses. These are neurological diseases. The psychiatric illnesses are opinion. I would consider them types. So I watched as as more and more the psychiatrists decided that they were going to press this claim that there were real mental illnesses. And in fact, I don't know, I'll tell you this a little bit about what happened in the 1970s. There was finally, in 1978, a psychiatrist, particularly named Gerald Clareman, threw down the gauntlet and produced the Psychiatric Manifesto, which came with said things like this. Psychiatry is a branch of medicine. Psychiatry treats people who are sick and who require treatment for mental illness. There is a boundary between normal and the sick. None of this is scientific. There was no new science involved in this. This was all marketing. Well, what we see today and what I've followed and watched is that as the psychiatric Bible grew and grew, there were more and more parts of human existence, you know, human problems that were characterized as mental disorders, and more drugs. And perhaps the worst thing that I have seen is that the children being put on psychiatric drugs. It's one thing if there are adults who we assume can make their own decision, but children can't make a decision. They're being put on powerful drugs that may distort the whole rest of their lives.
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual continues today with number 5.
Correct.
And it is the most accepted model for evaluating a person's mental health by official standards. There's also a growing number of health professionals criticizing the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual and its usefulness. I consider it a comic book. In fact, no more valuable than a comic book. It's all myth. There's nothing legitimate to it. And at the same time, states and cities are attempting to push legislation that would require psychological screening of children before they enter public schools. And now there's a mandate to try to have all adults in America go through a mental screening for depression. And by the way, this is still in the works in New York City, and Texas is aggressively pushing this kind of policy, as well as other states. And the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual would undoubtedly serve as the template for evaluations in using this worthless, fraudulent, completely corrupt garbage as a basis for deconstructing the idea that dysfunctional behavior is identical to a medical treatment, as you mentioned. If you have Parkinson's, you can determine Parkinson's. You have cancer, you'll find the cancer. But with bipolar, you won't find anything. You just find behavior. And then they're immediately going to say, in the public, in your personal interest, you must be on these drugs. And there'll probably be, if you do not go on the drugs, you can be forced to go on them for your own good and society's own good. And Hillary Clinton is one of the major advocates, along with all the corporate blue dog Democrats. I don't think they've ever seen a drug that, for psychiatry they would oppose to. And that's why I'm so concerned about who gets into power, because the next thing is the pharmaceutical industry, who helps put these people in power. They're one of the guiding forces, will say, push the legislation just like they're doing with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which she fully supports, by the way. Bernie Sanders does not. If it came down to, and it should be Jill Stein, as the person who is the determining factor, but unfortunately people don't still in this country believe in a third-party candidate. But if it was between Bernie Sanders saying, I will not support the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I will not support GMOs and will support organic, a huge difference in these two. But she is a big pusher of pharmaceutical psychiatry and psychiatric diagnosis and treatment. Your thoughts on this?
I think that we as a country need to pay attention to this and push, if you can push politicians, which doesn't look like we can, but if we accept, let me back up a minute and tell you why I detest the term mentally ill, which I think plays right into this. I think we have come to believe that, you know, we may be, looking at it as trying to be helpful or trying to tell people that, you know, that we're sympathetic, But no matter what, it is a derogatory term that we are trying to say that there are some people, unlike us, who are sick and who are somehow less than human. Whenever I hear the term that we want to eliminate the stigma of mental illness, I think, well, then stop insulting people. So I think that we as a society have to stop making these lines between normal and abnormal and realize that we all have our problems. We all fall someplace on dimensions that I call dimensions of dysfunction. And I think that the politicians willfully, because they get monies from pharmaceutical companies or just because they're part of a society that believes that there are some people who are mentally ill, that there are people that should be diagnosed and should be put on medication, I mean, they have to learn, or we as a society have to learn, that there's no truth in this. There is no mental... Well, let's put it this way. There are people who are very dysfunctional, but they are not sick. And they certainly are not mentally ill. Is that fair enough?
Yes, it is. And that brings me to this final issue, and that is, what do you see as being the most realistic alternative model to the dominant psychiatric paradigm in place today to help individuals who are going through some form of emotional issue so that they are not then misidentified as suffering from mental dysfunction and therefore drugged or institutionalized?
Okay, I think I talk about an ecological rather than a medical model. People don't, if they don't have diseases, what do they have? Well, they have dysfunctions of various sorts, and we all do. But we are a combination of our biology, our psychology, and our social circumstances. Social circumstances, you know, people, it depends on your social status, on the amount of money you have, the kind of position you have in life, whether you get judged to be mentally ill or not. But we all have our limitations. We all have an individual biology. We're all human. We are all subject to human vulnerabilities. We all have life experiences. We all learn from those experiences, and we all have social circumstances. So the ecology is that we are all trying to do the best we can with what we have. And I look at it that way. I say that people who are having functional difficulties, the role of treatment is to try to move them up toward better functioning, not to eliminate a disease, not to try to medicate it away, but to help them learn to function differently, to change what they can change. In a funny way, it's almost like the AA model. You work on it. You try to do better. Nobody's ever going to be perfect. So we're not treating illness. We're helping people function better.
Fair enough. And there's a lot of ways that we could do that. And for another program, we can discuss ways that are least toxic and most realistic, because I'm sure there are many people who've come to see you and other more humanistic psychologists or psychiatrists who, because they had someone who was compassionate, understanding, listening to them, and helping them to better adjust to such circumstances they might not always be able to change, including altering their perception so they don't feel overwhelmed and anxious, that those people are living better lives today. I'd like to see the number of people who are on Prozac and who've been on it for a period of time and see if they could say the same.
It's a false choice to be put on Prozac or antipsychotics especially for a long period of time. It's a vicious cycle. It does not make people better.
Makes the pharmaceutical companies a lot of money.
Absolutely.
Dr. Robert Galen, thank you very much for being on today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
40 years of helping thousands of individuals using an environmental model that does not diagnose you as being mentally ill, but rather having emotional issues and helping you to better adapt to life conditions or to alter perceptions. Final note, let us hope that with the movement on the internet, and we've been posting, I personally posted probably 50 articles on the Trans-Pacific Partnership in the last 24 hours. Let us support those groups and organizations out there who are protesting. Let us hear you contact your legislator and say no, 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 do not implement it. It's been signed, but now it still has to be implemented, and we want no at every level. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.